The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong speaking to you from Brussels, Belgium. Gerald Ford is expected to arrive at about 8 p.m. tonight, and I hope to be at the airport to cover that event, as well as hearing any remarks he might make in an initial address upon meeting the Prime Minister of Belgium and other officials of NATO. Gathering here during these hours today, tonight, and tomorrow for the first meeting of this important NATO summit conference are some of the top leaders of the entirety of the Western world. They include the President of the United States and the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. It includes the Prime Minister of Britain, as well as the Foreign Secretary, the Prime Minister, Mr. Harold Wilson, the Foreign Secretary, James Callaghan, and the premiers of Turkey, Portugal, Norway, of the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Italy, Iceland, Greece, the Chancellor of West Germany, Helmut Schmidt, the French President, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, of France, as well as the Prime Minister of France, Jacques Chirac, of Denmark, the Prime Minister, Anker Jorgensen, will be here. The Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau, of Canada, is also attending. As I mentioned, the Prime Minister of Belgium, Leo Tindemans, who will probably meet Mr. Ford at the airport upon his arrival, and the Secretary General of NATO, Joseph Luns, from the Netherlands. He was the Foreign Minister of the Netherlands for a very long span of time. I just completed an interview with Mr. Joseph Luns and asked him many important questions, since the present configuration of NATO needs a tremendous amount of reassurance in a world following the recent shocking events such as the total debacle of Vietnam, the growing domino theory of Southeastern Asia with one government after another going communist or falling before a communist military onslaught, with the weakened position of the United States in so many parts of the world, and of course European anxiety about American resolve to fulfill the commitments even in the military organization of NATO. Now, in one way, it is a rather strange exercise to see these very widely publicized meetings of many, many heads of state, and actually just about anybody who is anybody in the entirety of the Western world is gathering here in Brussels tonight and tomorrow. And yet at the same time, we all know Mr. Ford comes here to tell the Europeans, primarily Mr. Wilson of Britain and Herr Schmidt of Western Germany, and all the other European allies, that they can trust America. And then they are to tell him that they in turn believe that he means exactly what he says. Now, if that's all this NATO summit meeting accomplishes, then perhaps it is going to be nothing short of a failure. It could accomplish a great deal more when facing the realities of the current situation in the world. For many, many years in the World Tomorrow program, I have been saying that our eventual attention would shift to Europe and the Middle East, because those are absolutely pivotal from a purely biblical prophecy standpoint. And right now, all of Europe needs to look toward the Middle East, as so many leaders do here in Europe. Let's just get our perspective of present world geopolitics for a moment. First, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, the alliance itself, and who it includes. It includes Canada and the United States. It includes tiny Iceland, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, France, Italy, Turkey, and Greece. And on its extreme western flank, Portugal, a separate problem we'll talk about in a moment, and the United Kingdom. The NATO allies have had to have almost annual or periodic reassurances through the entire post-war period that NATO is in fact still viable, and that NATO is a strong military force capable of meeting its intranational, multinational military commitments to present a strong bulwark of European security and defense against the ominous menace of the Soviet Union. But today, knowing that the strongest member of NATO is the United States, that the United States has borne the brunt of all of the terrible costs associated with NATO, that the United States has the largest troop commitments, that it has been U.S. power and will which primarily has kept it together, knowing that the many other countries of Western Europe experiencing some absolutely fantastic economic resurgence, even in the face of inflation, the lifestyle, the costs of living, the tremendous panorama of goods and services available to the average person in what used to be a war-shattered Europe must be viewed as nothing short of an economic miracle. And when you stop to think that these many nations have been able to turn their attention to such post-war economic recovery and going to the point of a glittering technological giant such as West Germany, while able to exist under, as it were, an American nuclear umbrella, and not having to absorb the incredible defense costs that have been borne by the United States, this, of course, is a problem continually brought up by those who oppose the disproportionate share of the American commitment to NATO, both in terms of troop deployment as well as in terms of the monetary burden that is shared by the United States. President Ford is here, then, to tell the European alliance they need to believe in American strength, will, and resolve, and he is also here very likely to ask for help. There's some other overtones to his visit I'll talk about in a few moments, not the least of which is economic and even deals with an American fighter plane, but for the moment, let's view again the global geopolitical perspective of the United States of America, who has had its will tested and found wanting in South Vietnam and in Cambodia, and has had one minor success, perhaps even blown out of all proportion to its realities by the worldwide press, as if everyone was so anxious to see an American victory in something. And of course, you know, I refer to the Mayaguez incident. But look at the entire situation as it clearly is. The absolute majority of all of European energy sources comes from the vital Middle East. Even as I speak to you from Brussels, Belgium, war rages, at least a virtual civil war in Lebanon, the formation of a new government, skirmishes between Lebanese or usually Palestinian guerrillas and Israelis continue along the Lebanese border, terrorist acts continue, the threat of war on a moment-to-moment basis is very real in the Middle East. The Western Alliance knows that any outbreak of renewed hostility in the Middle East could bring about an immediate cutoff of Arab oil, that the Arabs will now do anything they possibly can, politically, to in some way force some of the European allies, as well as the United States primarily, to quit support of Israel, to force a completely different policy toward Israel. Everyone knows this is the time of the reassessment of American policy abroad. American public opinion, widely circulated in Europe as being isolationist in trend, as being non-involved, to the point that many Europeans, even at the middle echelons of government, simply do not believe the United States would fulfill its NATO commitments. I think that that has to be taken into account, no matter what the president himself might say here at the NATO summit, and no matter even what the Congress might go along with. Looking, for instance, at the signatories of the 76 being dubbed now by the Israelis the spirit of the 76, the 76 senators who sent a letter to President Ford talking about generous aid militarily and economically for Israel. Yet in the event of any new eruption of hostility in the Middle East, every one of these European powers has got to face the realities of the threat of a cutoff in Arab oil, which would immediately bring the entirety of the industry of these economic and industrial giants to a screeching halt. And there has to be some kind of a contingency built in to the political realities of today. Now, originally, NATO was constructed during the darkest of the Cold War period as a purely military alliance, as the European Security, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, to be a big buffer zone and to stand ready that if any member nation were attacked by the Soviet Union, all of the other member states or member nations would come to the immediate aid of the member which were attacked. But today the problems are not quite in that vein. Today the problems are primarily political and economic. Political, first of all, simply because within NATO there are many problems. I think you all know the problems between Greece and Turkey. And I've mentioned that many times on the World Tomorrow program, that the United States is hanged if it does and hanged if it doesn't. In the Turkish and Greek Cypriot War, the United States was blamed by both sides because of a number of things, but both of these allies now breaking off relations with each other, totally hostile, yet still NATO members, obviously makes NATO very weak in the soft underbelly of Europe. Another problem dumped into the lap of NATO leadership has been the revolution of a leftist communist dictatorship in Portugal, apparently irrevocably sliding into a left-wing dictatorship. And that possibility in Portugal also raises fears that similar things could happen in other European countries. And that means a whole new definition of exactly what the alliance is trying to do in Europe, what it stands for, what its purposes are, what it intends to achieve in the event of any new Soviet hostilities is up right now for reassessment. President Ford is expected to buttress NATO leadership with strong statements of U.S. commitment to its allies in the face of a pullback in Vietnam, with the fall of Cambodia, and with recent events in Portugal. And that is going to be no easy task. I think there are many who obviously are going to make all the right sounds, who are going to say they believe Mr. Ford, and they might say they believe the American Congress, with a little bit of an additional sign of support for Gerald Ford and a strong kind of a president who is willing to send American troops, as witness the Mayaguez incident, into some limited tactical military activity if he must, if the stakes are serious enough. But the continued problems and the continued questions for NATO means trouble from many, many quarters. One is the continued problem of costs. The United States of America has had to take the basic load, which is disproportionate, and we have continually seen voices in Congress which have been raised against this. Almost every single month, the question about American pullback comes up, yet now NATO leadership, as Mr. Lunds just told me less than an hour ago, is very encouraged because the United States has sent two fully equipped additional brigades to bolster up its own military commitment to NATO. Another problem is that of military hardware, and that even has economic overtones. For instance, I asked Mr. Joseph Luntz, who is Secretary General of NATO, whether or not there were economic overtones in the upcoming Belgian decision as versus the American F-16 lightweight fighter plane or the Mirage 1. It's interesting that Mr. Ford is here to discuss that as well as to address the NATO leadership. It's widely publicized here that Denmark, Belgium, and the Netherlands are all about ready to opt for the F-16, but Belgium so far is the main holdout. Now, the Prime Minister of Belgium, Mr. Leo Tindemans, with whom I hope to obtain an interview, and he's a busy schedule of being with all these other prime ministers right now, it's beginning to look increasingly like that may be impossible. They have a literal nightmarish schedule. It begins at something like 7 in the morning and goes till about 10 at night, and I think you can well understand, with the prime ministers of so many nations here, as well as their ambassadors and many other lesser officials, the schedule of all the meetings and greetings, the cocktail parties, the press conferences and the speeches and so on, is going to be extremely hectic. But the Belgian Prime Minister just returned from a visit to France where he discussed the entire picture. The economic ties are very close between Belgium and France. The entire picture, then, of the choice that is upcoming on a standard NATO fighter aircraft to replace the aging F-104 Starfighters. Already, some of the smaller countries, as I said, have chosen the F-16. But they're waiting on an announcement from Belgium. So it's widely known that President Ford intends to discuss, immediately upon his arrival, as soon as he can, with the Belgian Prime Minister, that decision. Obviously, he's going to urge them to buy American. On the other hand, there are close, close ties between Belgium and France. The French President, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, and the Belgian Premier, Leo Tindemans, were talking very recently about that very issue, and so we're expecting some kind of an announcement along those lines within just hours after Mr. Ford's arrival here, and I'm sure you'll read of that in very short order. The United States very badly needs that business because it towers up into the many billions, but by the same token, so does France need the business. And by the way, I was at the very factory where the F-1 is made, was at the assembly line on my last trip over here, which is down at Bordeaux, and is the very same factory that produces the Fanjet Falcon. As a matter of fact, they're produced in the same factory at the same plant by the airport there in Bordeaux. And I was given the unusual opportunity because a top official of Dassault Sud Aviation was able to get permission directly from Mr. Dassault himself, who is now 83 years of age. I was able to see the Falcon 50 before any other members of the press were able to see it, even as the paint was drying and they were taking the paper off of it, which is the mock-up, which will be on view at the Paris Air Show. And I expect to get down to Paris in a couple of days. We'll be talking to you from on the spot there with some of the events of the display of military and civilian air hardware before the eyes of the world in the annual Paris Air Show. So you see that with both the French and the Americans wanting these NATO nations to choose their own new lightweight fighter, it means a multi-billion-dollar deal. And of course, no doubt, France is exerting as much pressure as it can upon Belgium, that is the pivotal now member, that because of the number of aircraft that are going to be purchased, by the way, and that's the whole point, is that each one of the separate nations has its own private arsenal, as it were, but NATO officials have appealed for standardization. They want to have the same type rifles, you may remember way back when they chose the 303 as a standard weapon for all NATO forces. They want ammunition and aircraft and equipment and so on to be interchangeable and standard so that the defense forces could have basically one training command and that type of thing. But the economic overtones are rather interesting when you have a French and an American president both appealing to the Belgian prime minister to buy either French or American. Now, the real problem is that there is no protection in Europe's soft underbelly, and NATO is shakiest in those areas. NATO has virtually no influence whatsoever in the Middle East. When you look at Greece and Turkey on the very eastern flank, and the very fact of their very shaky membership in NATO now, and their absolute hatred for each other, and the possibility of renewed conflict there, when you see that NATO has no forces whatsoever of any note in the Indian Ocean, or around the southern tip of the Cape of Good Hope, and there needs to be something done, as anyone can plainly see, about some kind of new detente, even between some of the NATO countries and the United States and South Africa, so far as that is concerned. So the sea gates and the sea lanes through which the vital energy supplies must flow that fuel all of Europe's industry have to come around the Cape of Good Hope. Even with the opening of the Suez Canal, that will continue to largely be so. Why? Well, simply because in today's scheme of things, most of the super tankers, all of the super tankers, and most of the other even smaller tankers are still too big for the Suez Canal. It would take months or perhaps years of additional widening and deepening to ever make the Suez Canal accessible to some of those huge tankers. So even though some smaller Russian naval vessels, and of course a steady stream of smaller tankers and freighters and other type vessels, can and will flow through the Suez Canal following its opening in a matter of days now, there is going to be no real change of the flow of the raw energy sources vital to Europe coming around the Cape of Good Hope. So the real problem for NATO is the soft underbelly of Europe, with growing Soviet might there, with aircraft carriers and Soviet missile-carrying submarines, as well as their nuclear-powered vessels and their missile-armed cruisers. They, right now, even though slightly smaller perhaps in numbers, are nevertheless far more up-to-date and newer than most of the ships of the American Sixth Fleet, and they pose a very, very potent power in the soft underbelly of Europe in the middle of the Mediterranean. At the western flank is the worry of the potential of a communist dictatorship in Portugal. Now, renewed hostilities in the Middle East could once again interrupt the flow of vital energy supplies to Europe. My question to some of the NATO leadership is, what will be the NATO response to any such interruption of energy sources or energy supplies to Europe? And actually, you can't get a direct answer on that, because in the confines of NATO policy, there exists no such statement. I doubt very much if you would get anyone in NATO to answer that question directly, because I don't really think they know what they would do. It's already been announced that there is a plan by oil producers for an additional price hike, even up to as much as 30% over the next 2 years, so energy is going to cost more. But the very most important consideration is the possible immediate cutoff of the flow of that energy simply because of a renewed conflict in the Middle East. The now very famous 76 signatories of the letter to President Ford calling for unlimited or at least generous military and economic aid to Israel tended to appear like the American public and the constituency of those senators is prepared to go all the way with Israel. On the other hand, the Arabs hope that the United States, during its period of reassessment of foreign policy and during its setbacks in southeastern Asia, will change its policy toward Israel. And President Ford's talks with President Sadat of Egypt could, of course, do just that. So whether any Geneva talks between the leaders of the Middle East ever take place, whether any Geneva conference comes up, is still a moot point. Whether the PLO would be present or not, whether the Israelis would ever sit down with the PLO, which they tell me they would not, and I just brought you interviews from leaders there, and they reiterated that very firm position, it looks like there is not much hope for a really early settlement in the Middle East on the immediate horizon. Yet, unless there is, this still looms large as the very biggest trouble spot on the face of the earth. Now, when you look around the world, you wonder, where is the next test of American strength going to come? The American president is coming here to Europe to meet with the heads of state of most of the entirety of the Western nations, with the only exception being some of those of Central and South America. But you might as well say the total leadership of all of the industrial powers of the Western world are here in Brussels, Belgium, right now, as I speak to you from NATO headquarters in Brussels. And the American president is here to tell these European powers that they can trust the United States, that they can believe the United States leadership, that they can depend upon the United States for honoring its commitments. But unfortunately, he's here just in the wake of some of the most incredible defeats the United States has ever suffered, with the one little, and perhaps it's been blown out of proportion somewhat, the one little exception of the Mayaguez incident. So it's about time we looked at the overview of world conditions and understood the incredible difficulties through which the United States is presently going. The current challenge in this world is one between the Soviet Union and the Western world for virtual dominance of the world. We live in a time of nuclear overkill, with the deployment of nuclear weapons around the world. As I speak to you from Brussels right now, prowling offshore of the United States in the Soviet missile-carrying submarines is enough nuclear might to more than exterminate the United States many times over. At the same time, in the Mediterranean and up in the polar Arctic area and clear over off of Vladivostok are American submarines ringing the Soviet Union. Here inside Europe, the huge arsenal of conventional weapons as well as nuclear weapons and tactical or limited nuclear weapons capable of being discharged through cannon or through shorter-range surface-to-surface missiles or through air-to-surface missiles from aircraft or being carried in the bomb bays of big bombers are hundreds and hundreds, upwards of 1,000 and more American nuclear bombs of multi-megatonnage. In missile silos all across Europe are such nuclear warheads. In MIRVs, that's the Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicle that I've talked about so much, and the Soviet Union under SALT I is able to catch up in its building of MIRVs and its deployment of huge missiles. As a matter of fact, that's another subject I can talk about later, but the SALT II, or the Strategic Arms Limitations talks that are going to be upcoming, will deal with inspection problems as to how the Soviet Union will be willing to go along with United States surveillance and inspection of the deployment of additional MIRV sites. So here is a world between the two superpowers of the Soviet Union and the United States, vying and juggling for position. But the Allies, the dependence in that sense upon American strength and American resolve here in Europe, while strong, do not have on their own anywhere near the armed forces that they would need in the event of a complete collapse of NATO. It is only within the confines of NATO and basically upon American guarantees that Western Germany, that Belgium, France, and all these other countries can be given some kind of a guarantee of security in the face of a Soviet threat. Yet, Europe is tied directly in its industry, its economy, and even for its military strength upon the vital flow of oil and of energy that must come from the Middle East. Now, I've talked so many times recently about what it says in Daniel, the 11th chapter, and it's all the more poignant today because just as Mr. Ford is here to reassure all these European leaders, if something were to occur in the Middle East, which would cause the Arabs once again to either threaten or to actually proceed with an oil embargo against Europe, that could call the European tune, and they would dance to that tune. Any tune the Arabs wished to call, you would find the Europeans almost immediately going along. The Arabs, I honestly believe, today could clamp down on oil once again and virtually force Europe out of the configuration of NATO. They could bargain by saying, we want you to completely turn your back on Israel. We want no further economic help or aid. We want no business, no industry. You're to break off all diplomatic ties and relations. And they could virtually demand that or else no more oil. And the big question is, what would Europe do about it? Could any European defense force unilaterally go sailing down into the Persian Gulf and literally attack and occupy some of those Arab countries? No, I doubt it. Would they do so? I doubt that very much. In the first place, they simply couldn't under the geopolitics of the present world. And yet Bible prophecy in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel talks about a king of the south who was going to in some way push at, shove at, which seems to be economic in nature, which certainly seems to smack of a renewed Arab oil embargo, some king of the north. And that king of the north is going to be the leader of yet a completely different configuration of nations that emerges here in Central Europe. And I do believe, and I've said for so many years, that Western Germany is destined to be at its helm and at its head. You're going to see some dramatic happenings inside NATO, inside Europe, in the months and the very few years just ahead. We'll see whether the United States is of a mood to commit troops and to literally become involved or embroiled in some other military activity in some other yet remote part of the world. I'm going to break off in just a few moments now. I'm speaking from a soundproof booth right up here above the press center in NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium. Down below me are the men banging away on typewriters, lines of them, must be 50 or 100, I don't know. There's a huge room of four or five tables lined with typewriters here, and representatives of the press from country after country all around the world are here today. This is a very busy beehive of activity, and their aircraft arriving at the airport, and sirens and police guards everywhere, tremendous amount of security, and obviously so with the premiers and the prime ministers of so many countries here on the spot. And by the way, some of these interviews I'm writing up is in article form for the current number of The Plain Truth. I'm here in Brussels at the headquarters of NATO. We'll be going for the arrival of the President of the United States, and I'll bring all of you along the way the sounds of what that was like at the airport. And of course, if I can get it to the area where I can actually hear any remarks Mr. Ford makes, perhaps I can bring you those as well. Don't forget, the current number of The Plain Truth will carry articles on this NATO summit, and also articles from other major happenings around the world as viewed in the light of Bible prophecy from the true overview, the global overview of world events. This is Garner Ted Armstrong saying you ought to write for the current number of The Plain Truth and get your name on a mailing list to get these articles in the wake of Gerald Ford's trip abroad to Austria, to Spain, and to the nation of Belgium, where I was present. While you're at it, you ought to request the booklet called Why Prophecy, and the brand new booklet just off the press, a shortened, up-to-the-moment booklet of an earlier, much larger one called The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy. We're looking backward at 200 years history. It's time we look forward into Bible prophecy. What is going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, and 25 years? The futurists in Washington, D.C. are wondering about that. But you, when you read The Plain Truth in these booklets, can know.
All you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.